I'm Alex Hall Hall.
I'm Jason Pack, and this is Disorder,
the podcast where we try to find order in our mad, bad, and unfortunately sometimes genocidally bad world. And this week, to commemorate Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, which is April the 24th, this is going to be the first of a two-part series with Dr. Armen Sarkissian, Armenia's former president from 2018 to 2022, its former prime minister, a post he served in from 1996 to 1997, and a host of ambassadorships, making him one of the most accomplished international figures from that region. He has not only been the longest serving ambassador to the UK, but also, incredibly, ambassador to the Vatican, the EU, NATO, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, and even senior ambassador to Europe as a whole. He is also a physicist, an investor, and computer scientist, and as you will hear in this interview, something of a philosopher as well.
I do most of that stuff before breakfast, Alex. I represent my credentials
to the
Court of St. James. I do some ambassadorialing with the Pope. I mean, come on. Who doesn't?
Well, I multitask, but it mainly involves my kids, my dogs, my house, and the podcast. I mean, he is quite a formidable character. And what I really love about your interview with him, Jason, is it's like he's looking back with all these decades of experience and wisdom. You know, he can take pride in what he's achieved.
Yeah.
We're still working on it, Jason. We're still working on our CVs.
Yeah, I still feel like my best years are behind me, but maybe a little less was accomplished in those years.
Nonsense. This podcast means we both have a very new and interesting lease on life. And I think the best years of this podcast are ahead of us.
That I can agree with. So about the interview, I mean, as Dr. Sarkissian looked back at what he has experienced and lived, I think a really interesting thought process occurred to me, which is, does the world that we're living in now with all its disorder make the possibility for tragic crimes like genocide more likely than if we were, you know, back in the days of a more ordered world? And then why do we need to remember and commemorate, you know, history's tragedies? And he had the compelling argument, which is that what happened to the Armenians really needs to be a cautionary tale.
Absolutely. And I think that was the grounds for President Biden to break the precedent of previous American presidents and decide in 2021 that he was actually formally going to recognize what happened to the Armenians from 1915 to 1923 as a genocide. And he explained his rationale being that unless we call it out for what it is, we risk making the same mistakes again.
Well, before we delve further into this topic, I think it's important to give listeners a sense of what the Armenian Genocide was about. To be as neutral as possible, I'm going to selectively read some lines from the Encyclopedia Britannica entry of the Armenian Genocide, and I'm putting the link in the show notes. So, the Armenian Genocide was a campaign of deportation and mass killing conducted against the Armenian subjects of the Ottoman Empire by the Young Turk government during World War I. Armenians charged that the campaign was a deliberate attempt to destroy the Armenian people and thus an act of genocide. The Turkish government has resisted calls to recognize it as such. The genocide happened during World War I out of a Ottoman view that the Armenians were not loyal subjects willing to fight Russia, and hence, as enemies within, they needed to be, quote-unquote, dealt with. So, on April 24th, 1915, Talat Pasha ordered the arrest of approximately 250 Armenian intellectuals and politicians in Istanbul. Most of the men who were arrested were killed in the months that followed. Soon after an Ottoman defeat against Russia at Sade Kamish, the Ottoman government began to deport Armenians from Eastern Anatolia on the grounds that their presence near the front lines posed a threat to national security. The deportation, which was overseen by civil and military officials, was accompanied by a systematic campaign of mass murder carried out by irregular forces as well as by local Kurds and Circassians. Survivors who reached the deserts of Syria languished in concentration camps. Many starved to death, and massacres continued into 1916. Conservative estimates have calculated that some 600,000 to more than 1 million Armenians were slaughtered or died on the marches.
I think the other issue we need to discuss here is why some countries have recognized the Armenian genocide and some have chosen not to. And I already mentioned that the US in 2021 decided to recognize Armenian genocide, and the French, as another country who have long recognized the genocide. But then there are countries like the UK and Israel. It's interesting, the Israel one, they do not recognize what happened to Armenians at the beginning of the century as genocide. I mean, you could be legalistic and say one issue is that the Genocide Convention didn't actually exist then because it was only introduced after the Holocaust and the horrors of World War II. But of course, there's a more cynical explanation, which is that if you recognize what happened to the Armenians as genocide, you are almost certain to incur the wrath of the Turks. And indeed, when Sweden chose to recognize Armenian genocide, the Turkish government immediately retaliated. And we need Turkey. Turkey is an important NATO ally. It is a bulwark against ISIS terrorism. It is an important player in the Black Sea region. Turkey has an influential role on Ukraine and Russia. So there is a hesitation to alienate the Turks. And then the very last reason why countries are always hesitant to recognize genocide is that under the terms of the convention, once you have formally recognized something as genocide, you are obligated to do something to try and prevent it. And many countries don't want to incur that obligation, which is why during what happened in Rwanda, it was not formally recognized as genocide at the time. It was only afterwards, when the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda was set up, that finally several former Hutu individuals were found guilty of committing genocide. So countries don't want genocide to be declared.
From any sane perspective, if the word genocide has any meaning, and if the Holocaust was one, then the Armenian genocide was one. These are two sui generis parallel events, and I think it's really important to put them into conversation, really begging the question, which we're going to get to in the interview, why has the Armenian genocide been largely forgotten? But enough from us, Alex. Funny to hear us pontificating about the Armenian genocide when I just interviewed pretty much the most famous living Armenian politician. Let's hear from him.
When I was a young prime minister of Armenia in 1996, around 40 years old, I knew how to change the country. I had a clear understanding for the next 15 years, what to do, how to reform, what sort of investments, how to make Armenia as another, let's say, Holland. And Armenia, those years, could have bought as a state oil and energy and other assets in former Soviet unions, which were available. So a model for future of Armenia was there. Of course, that model included, very, very importantly, how to create peace in the region and how to negotiate. And those moments were the best moments, even when I retired. For several years, the Armenian side has had the sort of opportunity or the privilege to negotiate peace from the point of view of strength. Because those years, Armenian side had won the first Karabakh War and being strong.
And this is the war at the end of the Soviet Union. Essentially, just to give our listeners some more context who may not know, this territory, mostly populated by ethnic Armenians, was given by the Soviet Union to Azerbaijan. Many consider this to be quite unfair. And as the Soviet Union broke apart, this war was precipitated, which Armenia won.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it started before the Soviet Union broke apart. It started in 1988, and in fact, it never had stopped during all of the Soviet years, even under Stalin. The issue was raised many times.
You could say that this issue was actually quite key in the timetable of how the Soviet Union broke apart.
Yes, in fact, I think Armenia was one of the first to start huge demonstrations in 1988, and the initial motive of that those demonstrations were independence of Nagorno-Karabakh and the fate of our compatriots in Azerbaijan, but then gradually it became sort of a movement for independence of Armenia. But when I was prime minister, I could see that ever in each war, even if you win a war on the ground, the final victory is there when it is signed and sealed by diplomats in a negotiation. And that was the best time for Armenia to negotiate because we were victorious at that time. Azerbaijan was weak. They didn't have the pipeline to export oil. And there was a big opportunity of negotiating a peace. And in fact, for me, Nagorno-Karabakh, the conflict there was also connected with the future of the whole region. And I think we had the chance of reaching a peace, a status for Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh, be that independence or indeed maybe a protectorate between Armenia and Azerbaijan. But as a part of that agreement could have been a pipeline running from Azerbaijan via Karabakh, via Armenia to Turkey, and that would have become a huge factor of stability and peace in the region. So that was my vision, but there's always act of God. And while I was energetically doing this, there was a sign from God that I have to go to a hospital because they found that I had cancer, so I had to spend around 1.5, 2 years in hospitals trying to fight for my life. So I learned my lesson.
I want to jump back to your kind of geostrategic thinking in the wake of the victory in the first Nagorno-Karabakh war in the 1990s, there was an opportunity for negotiations, and all conflicts need to end in negotiations. So I'm thinking, when people think about Armenia who don't know much about it, they may know about its legacy in chess. We know that Levon Arnonian was crowned U.S. chess champion recently. Furthermore, probably the most famous person alive with Armenian ancestry from Nagorno-Karabakh is, of course, Garry Kasparov. So given how deep the connection is between chess and Armenian scientific achievement, can you say that you're a product of Armenia's chess legacy? And how is chess and your country's intellectual and scientific connection?
I'm going to disappoint you about chess. I'm not a bad chess player, but no, I'm not as talented as indeed, Levon Aharonian or Garry Kasparov, of course. But I would say I'm a product of Soviet Union.
Tell us more.
If we go back to Cold War years, there was a huge competition between two, the West and Soviet Union. In the West, the big values were liberal democracy, capitalism, I mean competition, and pragmatism, and I think cultural values, the values of freedom, very important, the value of religion, and then the values of expression yourself and many others. And on the other side, is back in Soviet Union, you had authoritarian regime, no liberal democracy at all, no pragmatism in many ways, neither in external politics or internal one. It was everything was basically driven by ideology. So then the third one, when you come to capitalism, there was communism. There was no competition. State owned everything. Basically, you don't own anything, but you own everything. And of course, when it comes to culture, Soviet Union was the number one populist state on the planet because it was promising equality to everything, to gender, people, nationalities, religions. In reality, there were people who were much more equal than the others, the members of Communist Party. So that was the clash of these two. But Soviet Union had an advantage from America and the West, and that advantage was education and science. Because although everywhere it was communism, there was no communism in education. Because of the ideology, Soviet Union had to prove to the world that he had best scientists, the best sportsmen, the best musicians, and the support was very, very strong. So there was Soviet Union, communism everywhere, capitalism in education. And then when I came to the West, what I discovered with some disappointment that in many countries in the West, everywhere is capitalism except education, when it was communist. They found when I was very young that I had some talent in mathematics and physics. So I won several Olympiads. They were taking you to summer camps, education, extra classes. And when I could enter any university, and from the second year of my university, because I got all of the great marks, I was getting a stipend. I mean, we were trained to be the best physicists on the planet. So I am a product of Soviet capitalism in education.
It's so interesting the way that you sketch this out. And for listeners who are interested in this story, Armen talks about it in his book as well, when he explains in his life how he not only saw the irony of the competition in the university relative to socialism and mediocrity outside of it, but that you kind of achieved a degree of comfort that most people, even in their 50s, couldn't dream of, and you were just a graduate student.
Yeah, exactly. But I lived in Soviet Union, and that Soviet Union was, in many other aspects, was horrible because you were not free at all. So when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, I think the West was happy, victorious, emotional. That was interpreted as the great victory of liberal democracy, capitalism, and so on and so forth. And people started believing that the ideas of democracy, liberalism, and capitalism are so strong that what one has to do is just open the door. Every country in the world will become liberal, democratic, and capitalistic, and there'll be no problems, no conflicts, nothing. Big mistake. Because as further development showed, that you cannot interpret or you cannot exercise politics in that simplified way. Yes, indeed. So the Republic started exercising some capitalism, okay? Privatizing big factories, industries. As a result, in Russia, we have what? Oligarchic capitalism. Democracy in many of these countries became a sort of a pretend democracy. Basically, we pretend that we're a democracy. We have every N number of years, we have elections. But of course, we rig the elections. So I think the whole process of that, there will be a march of liberal democratic ideas on democracy on itself, capitalism is taking over. That was on a scale of belief of that. That was on a scale I was shocked as a scientist. So how on earth people really believe that this is going to happen? Philosophically, this was one of the reasons why United States opened the doors for U.S. technologies to go to China. Because the same way they had the philosophy, if we go to China, we help China become a capitalist country, at the end of the day, the capitalism and new ideas from the West, democracy will change China, and China will not become a competitor.
I would say that you've hit at something that we've discussed a lot on this pod, which is the extreme naivete of a certain neoliberal economic thinking, backed up by the extreme naivete of modernization theory. The idea that where there's growth, you'll eventually get to democracy, and where we have supposed free markets, you're going to have the spread of Western and pro-democratic ideas. This is like a religion because there's no way that it can be proven or disproven. And every time it hasn't worked, people say, oh, it wasn't done properly. And when it came to Alan Greenspan and other neoliberal and libertarian economic thinkers in America, particularly in our relationship with former Soviet republics, oh, well, we tried, but they didn't implement the reforms properly. You know what I mean? Because they're just corrupt Russians. And I don't think that there's anything more corrupt about Russians than anyone else. It was the structural incentives towards kleptocracy because this theory doesn't
work. And of course, what you get is pretend democracies, which are not, and pretend capitalism, which is not capitalism as well. And the world has changed because if early 90s, that was the time that international organizations, United States, could control and put pressure on many countries, including Turkey. United States could have basically, maybe, theoretically helped Russia to do better reforms than they did.
After the break, why has the Armenian Genocide been ignored, forgotten? We're speaking just before the Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. And for me, it's a tautology that the Armenian Genocide of 1915 to 1918 is not talked about enough. It's not taught enough in school history curriculum. It's not acknowledged by enough major states. So I was very saddened by the recent September 2023 war in Artsakh, which is the Armenian name for Nagorno-Karabakh, which culminated in something akin to an ethnic cleansing. But it didn't elicit a strong enough international response. I've been ashamed at the lackluster response of France, Israel, America, who each in their own way didn't support Armenia enough. So I want to ask you the question about historical memory. Why is there so little cultural awareness by everyday people in America or Sweden of this topic?
I think it's a combination of many things. I think it's bad for the world, first of all. I do believe that disorders will happen in the future, maybe even in bigger scale than happening today. And during the disorders, always our sort of dark side of our humanity will come out and we'll see more killings and genocides. We only will learn stopping when genocides or misbehavior are addressed and recognized as a misbehavior and unhuman. Then maybe we have a chance of bringing to end all of this. Otherwise, there will be always people that will create another genocide in Cambodia or in Rwanda or anywhere on this planet.
Correct. If we don't learn from the past, we're doomed to repeat it.
I think that's a classical saying, but what I think it reflects the truth, and that Adolf Hitler was basically, when he was pushing the killings and of Jews in Germany, was referring that who today remembers the Armenian Genocide? Nobody. So he was hoping that nobody will remember also the Jewish one. But then it's also universal. Although there are a lot of countries like your country, United States, that has recognized on the level of parliamentarians and the president.
And I was very proud that Biden himself cares about this.
Yeah.
It's not just that he says it, he actually does care.
Yeah. France has recognized Germany, Russia, and so on and so forth. But amazingly, Israel has not recognized that.
Well, because of the very cynical logic of their relationship with Azerbaijan.
Yeah. Well, when I was on a visit on specifically when it was the anniversary of the Holocaust in Israel, I went there. I was invited and I went there. The president of Turkey was not there. The president of Azerbaijan was not there, but I was there. So were many other leaders, president of Italy, vice president of the United States, president of Russia, France. And the best speech that I heard among all of the speeches there was the speech of the president of Germany. I think at the end of the day, this is also a matter of humanity. I think recognizing every and each individual, including you and me, Jason, has done a lot of good, I hope, but sometimes we have done something wrong. And recognizing that what we did once or twice or three was wrong, and saying sorry, there's no shame there. I think that improves you, makes you much more freer and basically much more human.
I'm going to make a larger point. When a story is quite complicated, I feel that today's modern culture doesn't care about it. When I look at what happened in Artsakh in 2023, the situation, as tragic as it is just seen as complicated and people don't know the history. and Armenia's geographical neighborhood is so much more complicated from the perspective of your average reader in Ohio or Manchester, and that this kind of tragedy of lack of knowledge is that because the long, long history of Armenian scientific achievement in the diaspora is something which is not known, it's very difficult to crack in to the culture and to historical consciousness.
Whenever you do something, be you're proactive, you get a result. You have successes, individual successes here and there, in California, in France, in Singapore. If you go to Singapore, you ask about the Armenians. There's a famous hotel there.
Raffles.
Okay. Do you know who founded them?
An Armenian.
Armenians, the Sarkis family.
I know because you say it in your book. Not because I have been there.
So this is the answer. In order to tell people your story, because if you go to a small Singapore at the end, you find a small 100, 150 Armenians had created a huge impact. Yeah. The national flower of Singapore was created by an Armenian lady, had got her education at Imperial College, went to Singapore and created that. There's an Armenian street. The first Christian church in Singapore is Armenian one. It's still there, created by the same Sarkis family. I don't want to speak about others. What is the reason? I want to speak about myself. The first teller of my story is me. And that's why it's very important that a country like Armenia, although it's my homeland, I devoted a big part of my life to my country, but I cannot in honesty tell that Armenia is a very smart, successful state. It's on its way. I hope one day it will become. But you cannot ask others to do when you yourself don't engage your diaspora.
Let's talk a little bit culturally, though. Maybe there are some things that Armenian individuals and prominent leaders and business people might have done wrong. If you would ask a person in Britain or America over the age of 50, can you name one Armenian? Probably the one they could name would be Kalust Gulbenkian, Mr. 5%. And yet, when he died in 1955, he was the wealthiest man alive. But despite endowing lots of museums and libraries and a lot of good charitable works, the charitable monies was not leveraged effectively to create consciousness by non-Armenians of the plight of Armenians and to spread the knowledge about the role of Armenians in creating the modern oil industry, in building the Ottoman Empire, in so many different things. Would you say that there was maybe a misuse of Armenian wealth in not getting this message out there enough?
Yeah, well, it's a complex story. It's not as simple as you, because we have to remember that there, those years there was no Armenia at all.
Of course.
Armenia was a part of Soviet Union, that was Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic. And I do remember that I have looked at the documentation because I heard about this and I looked at it. Kalust Gulbenkian had offered the Soviet government to rebuild the holy city in Armenia, Echmiadzin, where the Echmiadzin to Yerevan and build the offices and everything. And it was rejected by Soviet Union because they didn't want to get anything from bloody capitalists. That's number one. Second thing, I think it's very important to remember that even Kalust Gulbenkian made his money. He was an oil trader, businessman, and investor, but he worked worldwide. And it's his initial business place was Baku. And then he worked in the Gulf, he worked in Iraq, and he worked worldwide. So he was an international person. But if you take Armenians as a nation, you have to remember that 1915 and the genocide and basically the first Armenian Republic that basically existed only just a couple of years were gone. And most of the Armenian diaspora, there was always Armenian diaspora worldwide, okay? But the big Armenian diaspora was the creation of people who were running from Ottoman Empire to the
to Lebanon, to Syria,
Lebanon, to France, to Egypt, to United States, to California, to Fresno, to Massachusetts, and so on and so forth. They were still first, second, getting to the third generation of those who survived it. I mean, always when you are a refugee and you have lost everything in your life, it's so difficult to restart a normal life organization. When I compare it, it's amazing, but fact, Armenians are like many, not many, but several other small nations have this culture of keeping your identity alive. They build schools, churches, organizations. It takes time. They become very successful and all of that stuff. But it's in a sort of genetic behavior of Armenians because of being an old nation. I was, during the Soviet era, because I was scientist, young scientist, we couldn't travel to the West because it was forbidden, but we could travel inside 1/6 of the world, which was Soviet Union. And they were taking to conferences to Siberia, to Vladivostok, and so on. I think you go now to Orenburg, Siberia, and so on. There are around 15,000 Armenians living there. In the center of the city of Orenburg, they have a church. They have an Armenian school that they take their kids. They have a museum of Armenian ethnographic museum. So they go, come to Siberia, they start having, as a couple of other small states or nations, recreating their own environment to keep their identity strong. This is what Armenians know how to do it.
I think now is a good moment to pivot to the last section of our discussion, which is what is happening today on the ground in Armenia and in Nagorno-Karabakh. And this isn't a topic that I know much about. I was invited to go to Stepanakert by my friend about 10 years ago. My very, very close friend teaches Hebrew in the old city in the Armenian quarter. And he is a very passionate supporter of the Armenian cause. And in the summer, when he's not teaching, he goes to Armenia, he goes to Nagorno-Karabakh, he hikes there, he eats lavash bread, he runs a blog about the best lavash, he learns with, you know, different grandmothers in different villages how to make lavash with them. And he said, Jason, you should come. We were in Georgia together in Batumi. You know, it's a short trip, we should go. And I was like, ah, oh, I'm busy, I can't go. I'll go with you in a few years. I had a sense that I might be making a stupid decision, but I didn't understand how stupid. So, of course, I'm not going to go visit Stepanakert with my buddy anymore. So I personally didn't understand the extent of the fragility of this situation. And I want listeners to kind of grasp that we are in a reality now where it's not just that Nagorno-Karabakh has been lost for the Armenian nation and Armenian people, but it could be places like Tavush and Sunik could also be lost. There is a dynamic right now, potentially, of appeasement to Azerbaijan. And I have a personal fear that when Azerbaijan is militarily more powerful as now, that situation could be getting even more worse. So we're speaking at this really important moment. And I'm wondering, you know, there was this April 5 meeting with Secretary of State Blinken and Ursula von der Leyen. Oh, they promised $300 million in assistance to Armenia. But maybe this isn't enough. Where are we now?
Now, what is happening today? We are in a situation that a lot of decisions on the future of Armenia, they don't depend on Armenians and Armenian decisions. For a simple reason that we lost the war in 2020. Armenians from Artsakh have left Artsakh and gone, for the reality of life that we live in a world that there is no international institution, including United Nations, can interfere and basically put pressure, let's say, on Turkey, on Azerbaijan, can put pressure on Russian forces in Karabakh when Armenians were living there. So there is no international order or law and order that can support the small end. It takes you back to a simple conclusion. You have to do the things when you have the opportunity.
This gets at one of the things that I took away from your book, which is that Armenia hasn't been as smart as some other small states because it has simply copied a lot of what happened in Russia, and that the truly dynamic small states like Singapore, as being very dynamic, invent their own way that suits their circumstances.
Well, Armenia had great advantages. The advantages were in the early 90s that the same nation in the same war with Azerbaijan won the war. And one of the reasons, when you are winning a war, one of the ways, how do you win a war, especially a relatively small war like between Armenia and Azerbaijan, not a war that is happening now in Ukraine. How do you win war? You have to be ahead of others, ahead of your enemy, ahead of your competitor. Early 90s, Armenia, while building the army, new independent state, was ahead of Azerbaijan. Why? Because Armenians used the diaspora. In this case, the diaspora were Armenian officers, generals from Soviet Army.
Yes, yes.
They came back because they were patriotic and from the sort of a patriotic movement and voluntary fighters, they created an army, a professional army. That was ahead of the army of Azerbaijan, and Armenia won. It's the emotional part of it that the nation didn't want to be repeated another genocide. The memory of genocide was there. But also, you were ahead. Now, in the war of 2020, Azerbaijan won because it had open support of Turkey. And Turkey is a NATO member.
And it produces the most advanced and sophisticated drones, the Bayraktar 2 drone.
Bayraktar 2, which was given to Azerbaijan, and technology, and Israel was giving drones to Azerbaijan. Well, again, if I'm an Armenian of thinking first you have to blame myself, then others, I would say we should have been prepared for that. That's true. But Armenia's strength and successes in the future are connected to the big natural wealth that we have, which is the human resource.
Yes. Speaking of other dynamic moments in the past where things could have been done differently, over the years, there have been numerous proposals to partition Karabakh, allow some Azeris to return to parts of the territory while making sure that Armenian sovereignty was established over other parts. Why were these proposals never accepted? And in hindsight, was it a mistake on Armenia's part to not use some negotiation psychology of, we give a little more than we want to give, but we'll get more than we might get, and we cement our gains?
The best time for us to negotiate and get a result that will create not only a result issue of Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, but create a stable environment in the whole Caucasus was second half of 1990s. We missed that, and everybody missed that. Because at the end of the day, a stability and development and security, imagine if Caucasus was stable and secure from 2000s until today.
Would have helped the whole world and would have also decreased the tensions we have with Russia.
At the end of the day, the war of 2020 was a tragedy for Armenian nation. There were thousands of people that lost their lives, young boys. And there were a lot of them, thousands that lost their hands, feet, and God knows what, the future of their life. And it was devastating and, of course, morally destroying your pride, because in the first war, when Armenians won, and it's hitting your identity, who you are and what you are. But that also was an example and a lesson to the world, because the world didn't interfere at all. There was not much information about what's happening there. And as a result of that, Armenia was getting much, much less than Syria. Much less.
The West was not there when Armenia needed its help. And the Russian peacekeepers, so to speak, stood down and they allowed this tragedy to happen. This, to my mind, causes a trap whereby we live in a situation where no one knows if Trump or Biden or the West in general will actually stand up for our allies. We don't have the attractive power that we're going to stand by our allies. Wouldn't you think that this is actually the most relevant reason to make people who say, well, I don't know about the Caucasus, I don't really even care about Armenia. It's that, no, if the West's guarantees are not worth anything or the West is not helping its allies, what are we good for in terms of ordering the world?
We have to show that we care with anything happening, small, big. If we don't care, it's like a boomerang. It will go and come and back and hit us. I think if the world was smart enough to understand that the conflicts like the one in Artsakh, we have to resolve as quick as possible, early 90s, if we would understand that we cannot allow this sort of stuff happening, probably would not be where we are today, with the war in Ukraine, with what's happening in Gaza, and so on and so forth. But it's happening every day.
So we've talked a lot about disorder and how more disorder in the Middle East is going to have negative consequences on the globe. We here at the Disorder Program always like to end our show with something more positive. So please, we've been so grateful for all of the expertise and experience that you've shared with us. Now is the time for us to order the disorder together. If you were in a room with President Biden and he said, Dr. Sarkisian, what's one piece of advice you could tell me about how to order the global disorder? What advice would you give President Biden?
Well, I would advise him call other heads of states, because the world now is not run only by United States. So in order to stop the global disorder, I think we need now to the contribution of others as well.
So Jason, I really enjoyed listening to that interview. There were so many things in there that I didn't know. Like, for example, that Garry Kasparov has Armenian heritage. I had no idea. Another country that is a great source of chess players is, of course, Georgia. They all got claimed as Russians or Soviet, but actually they were from Georgia and Armenia. Another point that I absolutely loved was his anecdote about how the Soviet Union had capitalism in education and communism in business, and how we in the West have capitalism in business and increasingly socialism in education.
You know what? This is such a good line, Alex. I've been bragging about it to my friends since we recorded the interview, saying, you know what? I learned that if you won a certain prize in the Soviet Union, you got like a stipend for doing well on a test. But in the West, you know, once you get into Harvard, you get grade inflation and you get an A- in everything, no matter how well you do.
Absolutely. And the incentive structure at universities is exactly like the incentive structure for producing tractors in the former Soviet Union. It didn't matter if they worked or not. All that mattered was how many you churned out, right? So when the bosses visited, you could say, we produced 30,000 tractors. And that's actually not dissimilar to some universities. It's about churning out the numbers. And there's a question about the quality. I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful insight.
100%. Another insight for me from the interview was about the failures of neoliberalism and then naivete in Western thinking about, oh, if we just, you know, introduce markets and capitalism into Eastern Europe, then they'll become democracies. We spoke about this from the very first episodes of this show onward, how naive Western thinking led to pretend market capitalism and pretend democracy because those regimes were able to game whatever rewards the State Department would give them as if they had actually had real markets and real democracy. And Armen pointed out that this idea that if we just have free trade between us or there's just no tax barriers, magically this means that your country and my country will become allies, or if you develop and become richer and have more manufacturing, you're going to evolve to being a free society. This is like a religious ideology, that modernization theory, there's no evidence behind it. You just kind of believe it.
Well, I'm afraid I'm a bit of a believer still. I remember that first episode, and we were hearing from Timothy Garton Ash, and I'm fairly sure he said in the episode, we weren't wrong to try it. And at the time, it wasn't an unreasonable assumption because we had seen it work in our own societies. And in fact, we'd seen it work in countries like Spain and Greece and South Korea and Taiwan, that once they had managed to throw off authoritarian rule, many of them did make a success of market economies and steady democratization. So I don't think the theory was entirely moribund, but I think the point that was also made in that episode is we were too slow to realize that just because it worked in some places, it didn't work in every place, and we were too slow to pivot. So we were naive for a little bit too long, but I don't think we were wrong to try. And for example, in some of the countries that we're talking about, and we'll talk about it more in the second episode with Dr. Sarkissian, I mean, countries like Armenia or Georgia, the one I know best, their security environment inhibits their progress. Their legacy inhibits their progress. So it doesn't always work for all countries. But I'm not going to say that it's therefore the wrong model.
I'm happy that we have some optimists out there. And I think, again, this comes back to our slight generational differences that I know you love hearing about, Alex.
I'm not going to hold your youth and inexperience against you, Jason.
You know, it's nice to have a joke around, but to bring it back to the question of Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, I really resonate with the tragedy of the Armenians over the last century plus. I'd like to read from a piece just published by Newsweek with the provocative title, Armenia Under Siege. Just months after ethnically cleansing Nagorno-Karabakh, which Armenians call Artsakh, the Azeri government forced 100,000 Armenians to flee from what was their homeland for a millennia. Azerbaijan has then recently attacked several parts of its border with Armenia, yet the world remains silent. Azerbaijan has avoided the imposition of Western sanctions that have affected rogue states like Russia, Belarus, and Iran. Instead of turning itself into an international pariah, the regime of Ilham Aliyev has attracted increased infrastructure investments from European sources. So that ends the Newsweek article, and I'd like to point out that next year's COP Energy Summit is in Azerbaijan, and essentially we've replaced European gas dependency on Russia with European gas dependency on Algeria and Azerbaijan, and these are obviously two unsavory regimes. The mistake is being repeated here. And I'm not pointing this out to say that Armenia is correct in everything. It isn't. And the Armenians, you know, they did some ethnic cleansing and some war crimes of their own in the past. But at this current moment, we need to grapple with the fact that because the West has been so limp in posing penalties on Azerbaijan for evicting over 100,000 Armenians from their homes, what's to say that they won't go further? I spoke to my Armenian colleagues here in London, and they are concerned that parts of Armenia proper, they can be taken over, and some important highways that allow certain Armenian populations to get their goods that those highways can be bisected as Azerbaijan is militarily ascendant now. Why would they quit when they already got some territory back, when they've gotten no penalty for achieving their aims by force? And I think this is a really important lesson, because we're thinking about appeasement and genocide and ethnic cleansing in so many contexts right now, in Donbas, in Gaza. All of these precedents are super important. But what pisses me off is that we just don't hear discussions of what the West should do in Armenia and what these precedents mean.
And this gets to the broader themes of the podcast, which is we are seeing a steady erosion of deterrence. Authoritarian leaders are looking at what happened with the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, our failure to uphold the red lines in Syria, our timidity in giving Ukraine what it really needs to hold back and defeat the Russians, and we could have given them more. And on every single time, they're drawing the conclusion that we don't have the staying power and we don't have the determination to do what it takes because we are afraid of getting embroiled in wars. And nobody likes wars. But what has been the reaction with Russia and Ukraine? Ukraine must defend its territory, but it mustn't go on the offensive and attack inside Russia proper, because we are more frightened of the consequences of that. But there is a danger here. The more we impose self-restraint on ourselves and on our allies, the more our adversaries think, you haven't got what it takes, mate. We're going to get away with it. And right now, the bad guys are getting away with it. And more of them are going to feel they should have a go as well. What Azerbaijan did was a totally opportunistic strike on Nagorno-Karabakh. And you're right, they have shamefully got away with it. All these fields of conflict are linked. And so how we respond, even to the crises that seem far away or not directly connected to us, like what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh and the prospect of Azerbaijan moving on even more of Armenia, these have consequences. It is really, really frightening. And so right now, we're all saying we must de-escalate, we must reduce tensions, but that is sending the wrong message to dictators. And I'm not a warmonger, I'm terrified, but sometimes actually fighting back is the best form of deterrence. So this is a fraught moment. This is a fraught moment. We don't want to miscalculate. We don't want to end up being drawn into World War III, but right now, all our efforts at self-restraint are not working.
So we've talked about what can the West do, Alex, and what has it been doing? It's not like they've rushed lots of arms to Armenia to help it defend itself. Not at all. It's not like we've offered them security guarantees. But in early April, I'd like to point out that there was a reasonably large EU aid package to Armenia. And I'm going to read from a EurasiaNet article that we are putting a link to in the show notes. The Armenian-Azerbaijani peace process is currently snagged on a dispute over possession of the villages in disputed areas of the border. Hoping to break the deadlock, Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan announced unilateral concessions to Azerbaijan, agreeing to hand over abandoned Azerbaijani villages controlled by Yerevan since the 1990s. Without demanding an exchange for similar Armenian areas controlled by Azerbaijan. The transfer has the potential to disrupt the ability of Armenians to travel on the highway linking Armenia to Georgia. Pipelines carrying Russian natural gas to Armenia are also located near the soon-to-be-returned villages. Pashinyan's proposal has accordingly generated lots of domestic pushback from various constituencies. And this gets at the larger argument of, if you lose a war and you're in the strategically inferior position and you don't have any allies or superpowers who say, this is the line and no further, the Azeris can say, great, we're going to gobble up a little bit more territory. We want these pipelines. We want these villages. We haven't laid down the law that we're giving this money to Armenia. We allow things to be as they are, but not an inch further.
100%. And having just sounded like a naive optimist about the power of democracy, I'm now going to sound more pessimistic, because of course I agree with you that you need an international framework and you need some standards that countries are not supposed to transgress, like invading another country, committing aggression, committing crimes against humanity. And the whole architecture after World War II was set up in order to try and prevent that. And what we're seeing today is that principle being ever more eroded as countries like Azerbaijan get away with seizing Nagorno-Karabakh by force, as Russia appears to be horribly getting away with grabbing chunks of Ukraine. And the cases go on and on.
We need to spell out for people that in 2018, there was a kind of velvet revolution in Armenia where people took to the streets and they pushed out the pro-Russian, pro-Kremlin Armenian leadership and a new, more pro-Western kind of leadership has come into being, but this leadership has been seen as either naive or incompetent. And the West has not received Armenia with open arms. It hasn't given it security guarantees. We're not pumping them with arms. And this may have to do with a legacy of this being the part of the world that used to be the Soviet sphere of influence and Russia's backyard. So it's difficult maybe for Americans and Brits to think we really are involved in this part of the world and that this is the West and this is Europe. Even though when you go there, and I know you were ambassador in the Caucasus, when you talk to Georgians and Armenians, they say, we're Europeans. This is the Caucasus. We're Caucasian Christians. We need to be understood as such and supported as such.
Well, Jason, that sets the scene actually brilliantly for part two of our interview with Dr. Sarkissian, where we talk about the challenges facing small states like Armenia, and how small states can play a more influential role in today's world. So that's it for today. That's enough from you, Jason.
And that's enough from you, Alex.
So next week, we'll have part two of our interview where Dr. Sarkissian will share his thinking about how small states can order the disorder. And Jason and I will talk some more. Make sure you tap follow to get that episode as soon as it's out.
And for more on Armenian history and to learn about the ethnic cleansing that has been happening in Nagorno-Karabakh 7 short months ago in September 2023, please subscribe to our free Substack. You can find the link to that in the show notes. And we're also going to put quite a few links in the show notes of this episode for those who want to learn more about the Armenian genocide or donate to Armenian causes.
Our producer is George McDonough. Our executive producer is Neil Fern.
Thanks for listening. Hope you have an orderly week.